Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight, our speaker will be Brenda Goliano. I think all of you know her. She's been very active in our Sangha. She's on the Abbot's Council, has served in the board, as well as in officer positions. And Brenda, do you have a title for today's talk?
Well, I guess it would be Zen and Relationships.
Zen and Relationships. Yeah. Right. Welcome, Brenda.
Thank you. This evening, I'll attempt to talk a little bit about Zen practice and relationships. Now, you might say, what does one have to do with another? Zen is about sitting on your cushion and watching your breath, right? And you are, in a sense, correct. A lot of Zen practice is exactly that. Committing to a period of sitting Zazen, like we just did, quietly, relatively still, and returning to our breath again and again. But then eventually, you get off the cushion. You're hungry, tired. Perhaps you have to go to the bathroom. You need to sleep. Perhaps you need to go to work, or to be with others in your pod. And that's where the true fun begins. How do you do that in a Zen way? Said otherwise, how does your practice inform your relationships? I think we each might have a wonderful answer to that question, so I look forward to hearing more about it. Conventional wisdom says that you are being Zen, meaning being Zen means that you're calm and sail through all the difficulties with hardly the blink of an eye. And occasionally that has happened to all of us, probably, whether we are Zen practitioners or not. It's wonderful when it does. But many times, even a person who is practicing Zen meditation can become exasperated, sad, joyful, angry, or perplexed. We are human after all. So how do you find your center in the midst of confusion? Well, I would argue the first is finding your breath. Have you breathed lately? When in the midst of an emotional overhaul, it might be quite difficult. Try it, perhaps a few of them. That's right, in and out. You might even try it now and see what it feels like, or rather remember what it feels like, because we all intrinsically know of this connection with what is real and true in us. Our breath is always there, always available, always fresh. It is truly our best friend. Next, I might suggest examining your feelings. What am I actually feeling? Happy, joyful, sad, hurt, angry, confused? Chances are, if you're asking this question, you're probably not in the happy, joyful place, although you might be. Usually in those states, you're just enjoying yourself and not wondering about anything else, would be my take. By really actually allowing yourself to feel the emotional state that you're in as it arises, I would add that your physical body, as well as your mind, you're gathering a type of information. With a little practice, you might even notice that there's a part of you that can be in the emotion, and another part of you that can watch the emotion while it is happening. This is kind of cool when it happens. It doesn't always. Sometimes you're just in the middle of it and need to ride out the storm a little bit. But eventually it will calm down some, and then you can resume this feeling observing duo. And you might notice something really interesting. Often there is an inciting event. Say the dishes are not washed, and you had hoped they would be. As you examine your feelings, you might notice on one side that you feel some sadness, some disappointment. How come this person doesn't care about me enough to wash the dishes? On the other side, you might feel blame or anger directed at the other person. How come they're not living up to their commitment? If you look really carefully now, right in between, at the crest of this mountain, between the sadness on one side and the anger and blame on the other, you see a little place right at the top. It's like the head of a pin. See if you can go there now with a recent event that might have stirred you up. You will notice that there is a very still place where there is not a very strong feeling, only a perception, and a place of relative peace and inquisitiveness, of no fault, no blame, of creative possibility. With practice, this little pinpoint of possibility can become a more regular visitor to our lives. You can be an angel dancing on the top of a pin. Between or beyond, right or wrong, it is always there. It might be a little hard to access at times. Maybe if there's enough room there, you can even ride a bicycle. And just as when you ride the bicycle, what is the most important thing? Don't look down. Keep looking forward where you're going. It is the same in human relationships. Let me digress a little bit. Last week, I was babysitting for my friend's 14-year-old son over the weekend. It was actually quite interesting. I thought perhaps we would get to know each other a little bit. I was even a little worried perhaps that we might have a COVID situation because we were not in the same pod. No such problem. I never got within 30 feet of him. We were perfectly socially distanced. We played video games the whole time upstairs, only coming to get something to eat when I was not there. It was very safe. I was very impressed that in the morning, per his mother's instructions, I asked him if he could please take a walk outside, and he actually did. I was very impressed. I thought that was some good parenting happening there. But I worry that in today's time, we're becoming too isolated and totally losing the ability to compromise, to know one another on a more intimate level, a level that takes into account all of our imperfections and mistakes and hangs in there to develop the understanding and intimacy that will sweeten a relationship, allow it to mature and bloom into something new. So not being able to interact with the young man, I read a book while I was there. It is called The Signal and the Noise by Nate Silver. It is very interesting, and a very technical book for those of you who are interested, about how we make predictions. And the central tenet of the book is that our brains are complex pattern analyzers, constantly assessing and making probability assessments as they assess past events against current and future possibilities. And that these assessments are of necessity most often wrong, but sometimes they're right, and we can learn to make them better. In fact, we are designed to do just that. Psychologists sometimes make a big deal about what is called projection, the belief of the patient that is placed upon the relationship with the psychotherapist. Sometimes that also happens in spiritual circles by a student upon the teacher. It is usually referred to as transference. And it also happens the other way around. That is sometimes referred to as countertransference. But that should not be a surprise. We are human beings. We are constantly doing that anyway. We're applying the projections or the models of our previous experience to our current relationships. It is only when these models are widely divergent from the reality that we encounter that this becomes a problem. And in analyzing exactly how our models are wrong, we learn. We refine them to more closely approximate reality. We can also combine models for macro and micro events. Often these become themselves systems and philosophies, isms of various sorts and sizes by which we guide our conduct. But our minds and our models can only ever provide us with an approximation of reality. Following any ism, whether it's a religious ism, such as Buddhism, Judaism, Hinduism, Christianism, the same is true, I guess, of capitalism, socialism, and communism. They may have powerful explanatory power along certain experiences and phenomena, but may also have inherent limitations. At some point, we have to leave the world of approximation and look at what is there. As Norbert Wiener, the absent-minded mathematician and father of cybernetics, who worked on modeling self-regulating systems back in 1948, said, "The best material model of a cat is another, or preferably the same, cat." Which brings us to Mumon Khan case 14 of Nansen and the cat. Once the monks of the Eastern and Western halls were arguing about a cat. Nansen, holding up the cat, said, "You monks, if you can say a word of Zen, I will spare the cat. Otherwise, I will kill it." No one could answer, so Nansen cut the cat in two. That evening, when Joshu returned, Nansen told him of the incident. Joshu thereupon took off his sandal, put it on his head, and walked off. Nansen said, "If you had been, the cat would have been saved." The commentary. Just say, what is the real meaning of Joshua's putting his sandal on his head? If you can give a turning word on this point, you will see that Nansen's action was not in vain. But if not, beware. The verse, had Joshua only been there, he would have taken charge. He would have snatched away the sword, and Nansen would have begged for his life. At the end of the day, when we have analyzed and thought about a process as much as we are able, we must step forward with our best effort. In the Analects of Confucius, there is a line that says, "Lord Qi Wen thought three times before taking any action. When the master, that is Confucius, heard this, he said, 'Twice is plenty enough.'" This is rare for Confucius, because he liked to think about things a lot. I guess I would add to this that it depends on the circumstance. Some decisions require once, twice, maybe 20 or 50 times thinking about. Each of us is also different. For example, I used to take a great deal of time to choose an item in the restaurant. It was because I rarely ate in restaurants, so there would be many competing models or variables. What is the healthiest? What would be the most delicious? What is appropriately priced? What have I never eaten or sampled? Optimizing these choices was always a lot of work, kind of like a calculus problem, and my husband would often become very impatient. I have since simplified it to two of the above, the healthiest and the never eaten or sampled, and my choice is made in 60 seconds or less. But most real life situations are not so simple. We need to consider different points of view. Perhaps talk to our friends and colleagues to see what we may not have considered. And we may need to sleep on it or evolve our view a little bit beyond reactivity to a more considered, mature action. And that's okay. And when you finally move from the realm of the possible to the actual action, it is important that you do eventually do that. Something happens. There is a shift. It is often a felt shift in the body. Even before the action has actually happened, there is a certainty that emerges. Just as in sitting, sometimes you become uncomfortable and you need to change your position during zazen. You don't want to move immediately upon having a sensation, but when you truly feel a deep need for a change, whether due to pain or discomfort, it is time. The mind has done its work of analysis, including integration of thoughts, feelings, sensations, and it is time to move forward. It is time to follow the heart. At that point, no one needs to tell you what to do. You know what you need. You can trust yourself. The most important thing is not to get stuck in the thinking, but practice allowing the needed changes to evolve in your life, in big and small things, gaining confidence in yourself, building that muscle, and encouraging each other to find that wisdom within us and cultivate it in community, and having patience and tolerance for mistakes, many of them, as many as you need. Because with each mistake, our models can be further refined and adapted to reality. With practice, the muscle of decision-making becomes easier and more fulfilling. And from each new position or shift, you gain a new perspective. Often so much is made of the large shifts in perspective. Books are written about them. In Zen literature, they're praised as experiences of enlightenment and cherished and pursued. But there are often so many little ones that have probably happened that we don't hear about. Many takings off of the sandal and putting them on one's head that weren't written down. So we have to have confidence in the path that has been handed down to us by our spiritual ancestors, a path that is passed down warm hand to warm hand, and that needs to be freshly realized in each generation for this process to continue to the one after us. Sometimes just a breath, sometimes a word, can shift entire worlds and might just save the cat. So when the time comes for your turn, you can trust yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda. We're now open for questions.
Hi, Brenda.
Hi, Columbine.
I don't have a question really, but your talk touched me tonight because just some things going on as of today. And like you said, I spend a lot of time in my head trying to optimize life, and that can be really exhausting. And actually what you talked about is similar to the advice that my mom gave today, which was just to kind of let it all go. And it's challenging when life picks up again. But I just wanted to say thank you. And I relate to what you were talking about.
Yeah. Thank you, Kalman. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda.
May.
Hi, Brenda. You really know our pain, right? Since you also know the medicine from East and West, I've been engaged very heavily about gallbladder recently. Gallbladder?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You know, by training, this brain never stops. Optimization. A gallbladder in the brain, you know what I mean? If that was constantly like this, that will create a lot of junk and a lot of heat in the brain. You know, right now I said to my son, asking me, Mom, what did you do? I said, well, you know, just get the poop out. You know what I mean? I just feel like this gallbladder, you know, in your field, how people started to, because I thought that was so important, because one day a people mentioned this gallbladder to me. He said, you know, he said, certain people, once you get into the room, you can feel it. Without talking, without doing anything, you can feel it. There's a field, magnetic field in that room, because if this people is really judgmental or do something, and there's constantly back and forth, and they actually change the whole room's chemistry. I was like, wow. And then I started to feel like, you know, the meditation maybe just help us a little bit, like, hey, give a pause, you know.
Yeah,
this is just my expression. I just I really appreciate that you point out that's our common pain in the Silicon Valley. So tell us something about, you know, in medicine. Sure. I haven't heard about any, like, I just wish everybody would love ourselves by protect our brain.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, May. And, you know, the gallbladder, for those who don't, you know, aren't up on their Chinese medicine, the gallbladder has to do with, a gallbladder channel has to do with movement and muscles, also headache and decision-making. So this is very pertinent to today's discussion. And so the gallbladder would say, the gallbladder channel is action, is people who are kind of very high energy gallbladder are out there running for miles every day, right? Those are the folks from with a strong gallbladder meridian energy. And so in terms of sometimes moving in small ways when you're feeling really stuck, it's just move your body, you know, go for a walk, get out in the fresh air. The springtime is actually the time also of wood and movement from the Chinese medicine angle. It's the time for moving, letting things relax, not holding back, just get out there and, you know, work it off. So it's a little hard with COVID now, but it'll get better. So yeah, just start moving in some direction when you're really stuck. My special talent is to clean the fridge when I need to do some writing. So gets things moving though.
We have Nick and then Anna.
Hey, Brenda, good to see you. Thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
As a cat lover, I absolutely hate that koan that you discussed, but it is nonetheless a really good koan. And so my question for you is that if you were a resident of the Eastern or the Western Hall, what would you say to Nansen?
I would pick up the cat. Get it out of danger.
It's a pretty good answer. I like it.
Hi, Brenda.
Hi, Anna.
Thank you for your talk. When you were talking about going to that space where there's still curiosity and no blame, I thought about how, at least I have a tendency sometimes when uncomfortable emotions come up, especially in relationships, to want to kind of spiritually bypass. And it feels good. It feels like you've come to peace because it's based on truth. So it's easy to believe and think you're doing your practice, but it's not really, really confronting truth or those uncomfortable emotions and working with them in the way that I think our practice calls us to. So I wondered if you had thoughts on that or an idea about how to tell the difference between spiritually bypassing and going through the process in an authentic way that's mm-hmm. really truthful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's a beautiful question, Anna. Thank you. I would say the difference between, you know, so first to just clarify a little bit what Anna is asking about, the idea of spiritual bypassing, which is that, you know, you kind of adopt a spiritual stance that things are okay, maybe bypass things that are very uncomfortable in either your own background or in what's happening around you, and kind of just take a posture that that it's okay, you know, and you can hold that for a while, but it happens at a cost to your inner, you know, your inner self, because you're not consistent across the whole level. You're not coherent across yourself. And I think the difference between, you know, facing a difficulty authentically and spiritual bypassing is that you really feel the feelings when you're being authentic. You pass through the feelings, right? You're not bypassing them. You're going through them. So you're owning them. You're feeling that sadness. You feel that whole hill. You feel the sadness. You feel the blame. And you experience it. Maybe, you know, even physically, you're like, oh, I feel really angry right now. I feel angry. I'm not saying it's just okay. I'm not saying, oh, it's okay. He didn't do the dishes. It's okay. It's not okay. It's not okay. You know, because he said he would, and he didn't. And so I own that. I own that awareness. And then, you know, in my own awareness, I see that I have both of those. I have the sadness and I have the blame. And isn't that interesting that they're both there? And is there, like, as you kind of walk up that hill, you're like, which one should I be, sad or blameful? And I see that I'm both. And are there any other options? And then feeling all of that, you can actually feel the third option, which is like, okay, let me see. Let me see what else is there. So asking that question, what else is there? And allowing those feelings to be present in ourselves, I think is what makes an authentic experience, holding all of it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Dave?
Thank you, Brenda. What you just said reminds me of something I read the other day. Was a short quote from a Tibetan teacher. I didn't recognize the name, so I couldn't repeat it. But what he said was, your fundamental choice is between the discomfort of recognizing your delusions and the discomfort of letting them rule you.
So, wow.
No fake composure here.
Right. Thank you.
Vanessa?
Brenda, what helps you to stay in discomfort?
The breath, for sure. Compassion for the other person. Understanding that they have their reasons for what they're doing that make a lot of sense to them on some level. Sometimes discipline. And I think taking care of yourself can be help that, because if you try to do it too much, there's a limit to us as human beings. And I have often been guilty of pushing myself past this limit, not recognizing that it's there. And then before I know it, I'm like yelling at somebody. And then I'm like, oh, isn't that interesting? I think I overstepped that personal limitation there. And so that can be tricky. You know, it's a learned experience when you're approaching that limit. And then you need to pull back to take care of yourself.
Mm. Yeah. So understanding the line of that limit too, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can push it a little bit. Like if you're in an uncomfortable setting, you can stay with it, but as long as you know how to take care of yourself afterwards, you know, and make sure that you have supportive relationships, especially in the caregiving profession. Like you're going to be in, you know, it's very important that you really take very good care of yourself. And it's a luxury. Most people think of it as a luxury, but I think it's more a necessity in any caregiving profession. Right. Or spiritual enterprise.
Right. If you had an instrument that you were taking care of people with, you'd take very good care of the instrument and you'd make sure it was always clean and well presented. So why wouldn't you do the same thing with yourself?
It's a really nice analogy, looking at ourselves in it as an instrument. Yeah. Thank you. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Jennifer?
I just wanted to share what I found recently for myself. Obviously, we're all learning, but it's really in, for me, it's been in deeper and deeper layers of kindness towards myself in terms of self-care. Like it, I thought I was doing a phenomenal job, and then I'll learn as I go, like, deeper. And if I'm on E, there's just like no way I have any capacity for anyone else. I mean, if I'm completely, you know, and sometimes you can have influence on that capacity. And then if it's like a physical limitation or for whatever reason you did everything right, but you couldn't sleep, you know, everything was set up properly, but it didn't happen because we don't have control. Then just having grace with yourself. And it, for me, it's helpful, as Brendan mentioned, I guess, when it's reflected by others. So like the other day I was in the kitchen and I felt like I needed my own space in the kitchen. And I was really being hard on myself because my husband had needed his own space earlier. And I was frustrated with it because I'm like to interact and wanted to work with him in the kitchen. So I just assumed that my wanting my own space was like trying to get back at him or something because of his attitude, you know? And I was very disappointed in myself because I thought, if I'm supposed to model something, you know, and him wanting to be with me, then how can I turn around and want to be by myself? But he pointed out that I really just did need my own space at that time. And obviously I could have done it more graciously, but it was my perfectionism I was stuck in. And it was okay to just say I'm still slightly depleted and I really just need my own space. So I think having someone else reflect it. And then the final thing that I guess brings me comfort or helps me be kinder to myself is thinking of someone in my life who treats me with that kind of care. So for some, it may not be like a family member. Maybe your family isn't that way. For me, my mother and my sister are both really kind to me. So I kind of pull on that kind of strength or love and then try to demonstrate that towards myself, you know, whether it's feeling like I'm wrapping myself in a blanket or, you know, of love or, because if I can't be kind to myself or when I'm not, then I put all these boundaries in other people, treating them just like I'm treating myself.
Right. So. Right. Thank you. Beautiful. Thank you. Well said.
May?
It's just something come up again. Thank you, Vanessa, for asking that beautiful question. And Jennifer, I think this is it. Also, I've been exploring quite deep lately, just about that, you know, what is your anchor to hold that, right? And then, but I'm actually more curious about the body, where's the body part, you know? Right now you mentioned, yeah, you rely on your breath. But now I'm curious that where's your breath come from? You know, how deep? And because I gradually observe that actually, you know, the voice is actually changing, you know, when you practice. And then something's growing. And then when Jennifer mentioned, oh, you know, I realized that this is my limit, and then I need to take care of myself. But where's that? You know, I sometimes imagine there's if a people have a much bigger belly, sometimes so think about that spacious, right? I mean, if there's a space, compassion to space, right? You just have more space for yourself or for others. But then I'm just keep exploring, you know, the anchor. Where's the anchor there in your body? You know, I think it's deeper, right? It's deeper. Whether it's come from your kidney or come from your when you sit, just like a tree, you know, where's the root out there?
Right.
Yeah, it's just such a beautiful question, such a beautiful answer. I can't help bring that.
Thank you. So I guess, you know, there's a lot of, you know, practices, you know, Qigong and all those sorts of things that help you to ground. But I think that no matter where you are, you always have your breath as long as you're alive. And so it comes in very handy. You could be in a car where you couldn't put your feet on the ground or hug a tree or something like that, but you always have your breath. And I think a lot is made of kind of trying to breathe this way and that way or that way and this way. But I think, you know, just following your breath, not trying to make it do anything else. Sometimes it will be very shallow. Sometimes it will be very deep. Sometimes it'll go from being shallow to being deep or the other way around. Or it may change as you watch it. And that's okay too. But just actually turning, you know, like we turning your attention to the breath, and you can, whatever is helpful for you. I mean, you can watch the breath come into the mouth, watch it come in through the nose. You can feel it as your lungs expand, as your chest expands. You can feel it in your belly, whatever pleases you to do. I don't think there has to be a special formula for it, but just being with the breath, that act of turning your attention inwards, begin the process of checking in, right? That's kind of what we do in Zazen, really, all the time. So I would say don't try to change it, because we often try to make it something different. And that's not really the point, is to actually just check in with what is real for you at that time. And it could be a very quick and shallow breath if you're feeling anxious, right? It could be difficult to catch your breath, you know. That's okay.
Giuseppe.
Okay. Hi, Brenda. Thank you.
Hi, Giuseppe.
For your talk.
Thank you.
That was really a collection of so many interesting considerations. I would like to hear a little bit from you on two things that come up for me hearing about Zen and relationships. One is that of focus. You know, I think in focusing on the other person can be very helpful, you know. And then when we sit, sometimes we focus and we have a difficulty, we narrow our focus on the breath, as you say. But that is a very good technique, time proven, to calm oneself down. But when once we are in a real situation, I've always found that difficult. Focusing instead on the other person, and focusing on seeing myself and the other person, has been more helpful, even if I lose my breath or I lose composure, so to speak. It's been more helpful for me to find a way to do something that then I sincerely consider the right thing in that situation. I would like to hear a little bit from you on this. And the other thing, you know, tonight we have talked, all of us have talked about that inner strive of like trying to, in some ways, control ourselves, you know. And that is also, you know, I'm very familiar with that, so to speak. And what comes to mind for me, since I started practicing Zen, is this non-Zen story of Ulysses, the Greek hero, that was sailing with his boat through Capri, where there were the sirens, and the sirens were singing, and he wanted to hear the song, but he didn't want to steer his boat away towards them. And so he asked to be with a rope bound to the mast of his boat. And then he suffered terribly through this sailing, trying to fight himself, knowing he could not control himself completely. You know, many people have asked tonight, where is my anchor? You know, he anchored himself to the mast and he put the rope on it. And that myth always upsets me deeply. You know, it is a myth that was told to me maybe since I was six by my grandma and, you know, two academic family. But it always upsets me deeply, this feeling of split and inner strife. But it's very difficult to, in words, express a different advice somehow. So how would you, how do you see this? What are you feeling around this second point? Sorry, two questions in one.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so I guess around the first issue, let me think about this. Around the first issue of controlling oneself and one's physiology and one's responses, I feel like this is a little bit of a professional hazard for us Zen students, you know, because we spend a lot of time really controlling our posture in Zazen, you know, making sure we don't move or we move only very slightly. And it takes a long time before we are truly relaxed in our posture on the cushion, right? A lot of times it's like, I don't really feel relaxed, but I'm going to work at it. And so I think that we can, you know, be tense. It's quite easy for us to kind of go to that feeling tense and holding it together in a difficult emotional situation. So I think that we should be cautious of that habit. The breath, you know, the breath is still a legitimate, I think, use during difficult situation, and it doesn't have to be a calm breath. It can just be one breath as you're like, you know, you're feeling the emotions rise. You're like, just take one breath, You know, almost always we can just take one breath. And that already starts to ramp down the feelings a little bit and kind of, you know, builds a little space, just a space. The other thing, I think I liked your focusing on the other person, but I would say not necessarily, or explore the possibility of not necessarily saying or doing the right thing, but really just listening. This has been something very hard for me. I'm not a good listener, actually. And I've been practicing working on becoming a better listener. And I think that the act of being listened to is very healing for people. You know, there's evidence for that, that just being listened to, not even being agreed with, or just like, I hear you. And starting there and letting that sink in and maybe breathing through that while the person is telling their story of what's important for them. I've almost always found out some very surprising things when I actually really hear people. Like, for example, let me give you an example. That's from my husband, you know, it's like, right, that's one of the things where we place as our best teachers, right? So my husband, trying to be a good wife, I was cooking these elaborate dinners, and I'd come up with these recipes and this, and I'd get home from work late and have all my ingredients and try to put together this thing. And he kind of liked it, but he wasn't thrilled. He wasn't great. And he didn't tell me for a long time that his biggest beef with this was, and I said, you know, you don't appreciate my dinners, and I felt unappreciated. And then he really said, you know, what really bothers me is the mess in the kitchen after you cook. And he says, you know, look, face it, I have like OCD, and I hadn't ever really thought about this. Like, I really like things organized. And when you cook, it's a mess at the end, because I try to do it quickly and I get home late, and it was a mess. And I realized, he says, I appreciate a clean kitchen more than I do a complex dinner. Oh, well, that's easy. So, but it took me a while to hear him. Initially, I felt very resentful that he wasn't taking my effort and all this. And finally, I'm like, oh, you mean I can just defrost something and you'll be happy? He's like, yeah, absolutely. Okay, thanks. So hearing. The sirens, you know, it's interesting. I don't know the sirens. I'd be interested. You know, Norm Fisher is a Zen teacher who wrote a book about Ulysses, and I forget the name of it, but he kind of did the interpretation mm-hmm. from the Zen perspective. I'd be interested to see what he thinks about the siren. I'm guessing it's how you relate to desire, you know, to your desires. He wanted to allow himself to have the desire, but also anchored himself to the purpose that he was trying to, his own mission and his own purpose. So he wanted to make sure that the desire wasn't stealing him away in some way. But I don't know. But I know what you mean about it being a, you know, a difficult thing. I mean, it's part of the hero's journey, I guess, you know, is the sirens, and that whole Ulysses journey is part of what the Joseph Campbell calls it, you know, the hero's journey. I don't know. You have to explain that to us more. I don't have an answer.
I don't have an answer, but you say the hero journey. I remember the habit was giving us the advice, get off the narrative. So that's not Campbell, you know, that's a Zen habit. And get off the narrative about yourself. It's that you create is interesting advice. It's not easy to understand all the way. It's like not having the must to bind yourself to, you know, it's like being a little bit in the water.
Yeah, I think being in the water, that's nice. That's a nice, you know, yeah, I think we have to explore with different models, you know. I think But maybe allow yourself to sit with that for a while. See what happens.
Yeah, I think so.
Any last questions for Brenda tonight?
Well, thank you for coming, everybody. Thank you for staying so late.
Thank you for your talk, Brenda.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.